Hi, everybody. Today's Tuesday, August 12th, 2025, and our friend Professor Morandi is back with us. Welcome back, Professor.
Thank you for inviting me, Nima. It's always a pleasure and an honor.
I want to start with the South Caucasus in the northern part of Iran. What has happened between the two governments, Azerbaijan and Armenia? Donald Trump said that they reached an agreement. It seems to me that it's too much. We have to be so much optimistic about what's going on to believe that Donald Trump can just bring the conflict in that region. But behind that, what's going on behind what the United States is doing in Armenia and Azerbaijan? How much of concern is Iran? Is Iran concerned about what's going on there? Is Iran, what would be the solution? What would be the proper approach toward what's going on there?
Well, obviously, the United States would like very much to break the link between Iran and Russia. And as a result, Russia would be isolated from the Persian Gulf. The north-south transport corridor would be held hostage. And the Iranians, too, would be disconnected to a degree from a key partner. And so that would be ideal for the Americans. And of course, Turkey is in NATO, and Erdogan is very much a part of NATO. I know that some of our friends like to believe that Erdogan is supporting the Palestinian cause and Palestinian people, but that's really not the case. Erdogan is very much in line with U.S. policy. He works in a way in which satisfies the United States more or less, whether in Syria or Iraq or Lebanon or the Caucasus. There is huge overlap between the United States, the Israeli regime, and the government in Turkey. So the Americans, what they would like to see is the link between Iran and Russia to be monopolized. And the best way to do that would be to, at least to the west of the Caspian Sea, would be to cut the link between Iran and Armenia. Now, one thing that I should point out is that when the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan began, Armenia occupied huge parts of Azerbaijan. And something a key point that many people don't know is that the Iranians, they were the only ones who were supporting the Republic of Azerbaijan back then militarily. And the Iranians began training them. And I've actually tweeted footage of the Iranians training their troops and training volunteers to take back their territory that is internationally recognized as belonging to the Republic of Azerbaijan. But Aliyev, the current leader, he expelled them under pressure from the United States. So he expelled the Iranians, and thus he delayed the liberation of huge parts of the Republic of Azerbaijan by decades. Then when the tide turned and the Israeli regime and Erdogan, but Israeli technology and drones in particular, when they were used and the Republic of Azerbaijan took back territory, and when Armenia was threatened, the Iranians supported Armenian territorial integrity. And when there was a threat of the southern province of Armenia being taken by the Republic of Azerbaijan, Iran sent large numbers of troops to the border and basically threatened countries that if this territory, including Azerbaijan, that if this territory is taken, we will invade. And those troops are there as we speak. Iran has never removed them. So Iran has a large number of troops to the south of the Caucasus, just in case. So this is where things stand. Now, Iran has no problem with any highway that links the east to the west of Armenia. where the two parts of the Republic of Azerbaijan can be linked with one another. It's none of Iran's business. As long as it is under the authority of the Armenian government, and as long as the Armenian government has full control over its own sovereignty across the land. In other words, Iranian trucks, private vehicles, trains, all of them must be able to pass through the border of Armenia, get to the capital of Armenia, and potentially pass through to Georgia, then Russia, or the Black Sea, without having any difficulty. So there cannot be any third party with troops on the ground or who have control over territory in a way in which which can impede Iran's relationship with Armenia and other countries that are alongside Armenia. If that happens, there will be war. In other words, Iran will enter Armenia. And Iran has already, in the past, they've shown that they're willing to do this. I don't want to go any further, but Iran has sent strong, very strong signals in the years past, in the two, three years that we've, the last 2-3 years, that they're serious. So up to now, up to this point, there is no evidence that the United States in this agreement has been able to undermine Armenian sovereignty. Now, some of your viewers will say that's being naive. The Iranians have been assured this, but that doesn't mean the Iranians trust everything that the Armenian and the Azerbaijan government say. And I think the Iranians will also be expecting written agreements with Iran as proof that this will not be the case. But at the same time, if Armenian sovereignty is undermined, the Iranians will open the road by any means necessary. So at the moment, I don't think there is any reason to be deeply concerned, but there should be concern. Now, two things that I think are important. One is that some say, well, why is it that in Iran you hear different voices? Well, the different voices are for different audiences. People in the armed forces will say one thing, but diplomats will say something else. Iran wants an excellent relationship with the Republic of Azerbaijan, with the Republic of Armenia, with the Georgians, with the Saudis. But at the same time, Iran will not allow its sovereignty to be undermined. So you know, it depends on who is speaking about what. Now, again, we don't know for certain what is going to happen, but at this stage, the Iranians are not cautiously optimistic. The Iranians are cautious, and based on this explanation that I gave, they will move forward. If Armenian sovereignty is fully preserved, then there's no problem. If it is not, then that's a huge problem, and Iran will definitely deal with it. Now, the final point is that it's also in the interest of Armenia not to have its sovereignty undermined. The Armenians recognize that if they become a cul-de-sac, if they do not have access to Iran from the south, then they're basically cornered by Erdogan. And Erdogan is ruthless. So, and he seeks his own interests. And Aliyev is an ally of Israel. Both of them are allies of Israel. So Armenia knows that it needs to have a relationship with Iran. So it's not as if it's just an Iranian potential threat that prevents such a thing from happening. It's also in the interest of Armenia. Just as Iran. So Iran's position is pretty unique. Iran supported Azerbaijan's sovereignty. It was the first to start training them until the Americans pushed the Iranians out by pushing Aliyev in the 1990s. And when the tide turned, the Iranians had the same position towards Armenia. I think it's the moral position, it's the legal position. Some Armenians don't like when I say that Iran does not support ethnic cleansing in Azerbaijan and the Armenians being ethnically cleansed. You know as well as I, we have many Armenians in Iran, we have Christians in Iran, we have many churches in throughout across Tehran. We have Christian MPs in parliament. The constitution says that Christians must have MPs. The different Christian persuasions have different MPs, just like the Jews have an MP and the Zoroastrians have an MP. So they're highly respected in Iran. But in any case, some Armenians say, well, you know, this territory historically belongs to us. The Azeris may say something different, but the reality is that the internationally recognized borders are what we have. And Iran has supported that from the beginning.
When it comes to Russia and the way that Russia sees the two countries, do you think that somehow they overlap with the Iranian vision, with the Iranian sort of strategy in those regions?
Russian and Iranian interests are converging increasingly in the Caucasus. As I probably said before on your show, that Mr. Erdogan has shown, and remember, your audience should know that I'm just an ordinary Iranian citizen. The Iranian government, diplomats they have their own language. I'm just speaking as an individual. But Erdogan's behavior over the last few decades have caused no one to trust him anymore. No one trusts him. No one believes him. Many thought that he was being especially smart by playing off different actors against one another. But I've always said, and others have also said, that in the long run, this is actually more hurtful than helpful. Because once a world leader is no longer trusted by anyone, he or she has much less room for maneuver. And so here in the Caucasus, the Russian and Iranian interests are increasingly overlapping because the United States has, of course, become more involved here. And we've seen the Russians target Azerbaijani assets, both inside Russia, but also in Ukraine recently. And I think that's a sign of rising tensions. And the Republic of Azerbaijan knows that at the end of the day, the combined weight of Iran and Russia far outweighs that of the Israeli regime and Erdogan because of geography. And so I think that is something that he will have to consider. So even though the Russians are focused on Ukraine as we speak, but the reason why the Russians got involved in Ukraine was because of NATO expansion and the threat that it posed to Russia. Well, the Caucasus are also they are no different from Ukraine. The expansion of U.S. influence, NATO influence in the Caucasus is unacceptable for Iran, and it is unacceptable for Russia. So the more the United States pushes, the more the Israeli regime pushes, the more Erdogan on behalf of NATO pushes, the closer the coordination will be between Iran and Russia.
What's the end game for the United States if we assume that the United States finally wants to get there to control the corridor that they call it Zangezur corridor? What is the end game? What is just disconnecting Iran from Russia? Is something beyond that? Because we know what has happened in Syria. In my opinion, one of the main concerns is the security concern on part of Iran and Russia when it comes to the Salafi Wahhabi movement in goes from the Caucasus, goes to Central Asia, then comes to Syria. It's a huge security concern. How is that? Does the United States want to be somehow facilitating these movements in that region?
It's not only that, although that is deep, very much a part of it, but also the Americans want to control corridors. And they don't want the Russian North-South corridor, which goes between Russia and Iran to the Persian Gulf and to Eastern Europe and the whole of Russia, because the corridors, of course, part of it goes from the Caucasus, but part of it goes through the Caspian Sea and part of it goes through Central Asia. But the Americans also want an alternative route that is that rivals China's Belt and Road. So it is economic as well. If the Americans control the corridor, then the Chinese are in a much more difficult position. But also, as you rightly pointed out, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all these other terrorist groups that NATO has been training through Turkey, through Jordan to a lesser degree, with Qatari money in the past, Saudi money, although the Saudis have distanced themselves from this sort of thing more recently. But these terrorist groups are basically to undermine rivals of the West. Except for on rare occasions, there's never been any serious attack by ISIS or Al-Qaeda in Europe or North America over the last decade and a half, more than a decade and a half. All the attacks have been on Iran, Russia, and countries that are rivals of the United States or that have hot problems with the United States, like in Pakistan. Chinese citizens have been murdered and attacked on different occasions. So ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they've never carried out an attack on the Israeli regime. Even in the recent fighting that we saw in southern Syria in Aswada, we saw that while the Israeli regime was bombing Jolani's forces and Jolani's Ministry of Defense and even the presidential palace, not a single shot was ever fired at the Israeli regime. It was only directed at the Druze, and often we saw the slaughter of ordinary people. So these assets, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, are NATO assets. And the United States would definitely want to be able to move them around in Central Asia, because if Central Asia can be disrupted, then the whole Belt and Road, the whole connectivity network across Asia is disrupted, because Central Asia stands between Western Asia, Eastern Asia, Southern Asia. It's a key connection point. If there is instability there, or if the Americans have control there, then the rise of Asia in general is disrupted, and the connectivity across Asia is key, because Asian countries do not want to be vulnerable through the sea lanes and the sea routes, because of the American Navy, because of NATO, because of potential antagonists. So these land routes are well protected from Western interference. And that is why the West wants to be able to interfere there.
Many people may not know the texture of the society in Turkey, but I would argue that you look at the Turkish society and Iranian society are pretty similar. There's a lot of elements, the common elements between the two nations. And I would argue, even comparing Turkey to Saudi Arabia, for example, that Turkey much closer traditionally, culturally, all these aspects. But when it comes to the government and the Erdogan, you see something different. You don't see that sort of understanding that you see within the Turkish culture coming to the government. What's that? Why do they need to help these movements, these radical movements that they've been witnessing how these movements are destroying the region, but after all, they're supporting them?
Well, you're absolutely correct. Ordinary citizens of Turkey are very anti-Israel, overwhelmingly anti-Israel. I would imagine similar to what we have in Iran. But when the Islamic movement began in Turkey, when it began to rise, gradually the deep state in Turkey and the military and NATO, they were able to make inroads. And they manipulated the situation and brought people to power who basically were cooperating with NATO. And so Mr. Erdogan, initially during the first few years, he did some very positive things in Turkey, and that made him popular. among a large segment of society. But ultimately, it turned out that he was just NATO. He was not, and he has been, sadly, using Takfiri groups and Salafi and Wahhabi groups for his political agenda. And that has created a problem inside Turkey itself, inside Turkey itself. You see it changing the culture and parts of society and among religious elements, the more religious elements in society, in a way which did not exist 15, 20 years ago. 15 years ago, if you traveled to Turkey and you met some people, some of my own friends who I'd meet, they spoke very differently about their own society. But more recently, some of them expressed concern about Salafism and Wahhabism and extremism in Turkey. So again, you have to keep this in. The key is to remember that these Takfiri groups are very much a part of the U.S. regional and global strategy. If you recognize that, then you understand where the problem lies. When Erdogan promotes and Qatar promotes Takfiri groups in Syria, they're doing it at the behest of the United States. They want a piece of the cake too, which is evil because these groups are utterly evil. But they're doing it at the end of the day in coordination with the United States. And we have to remember, Jake Sullivan on February the 12th, 2012, said Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. And ISIS was a part of Al-Qaeda. They separated from Al-Qaeda. And before Syria, it was these forces like Belhaj in Libya who helped bring down the Libyan government. Remember the Manchester bombing? The young man who slaughtered 20-some young kids at a concert in Manchester, he and his father were involved with these extremist groups in Libya. Do you think that British intelligence didn't know that? Of course not, they did. They were coordinated, they were working together. European intelligence agencies, North American intelligence agencies, many regional intelligence agencies were working together to bring these Takfiris into Libya, then into Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and elsewhere to push the NATO agenda. We have the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency document that was published, which was written in 2012 and later published, which said that the United States allies of the United States in the region wanted to create a Salafist entity between Syria and Iraq in order to isolate the Syrian government. That meant Turkey, that meant Qatar, that meant other countries in the region, Jordan, and so on. What was that Salafist entity? It was ISIS. This document was from 2012. And then the head of that agency at that time later on did an interview on Al Jazeera of all places, General Michael Flynn, who was the a friend of Trump. He said that it was U.S. policy to support this policy. He was the head of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, the most important military agency in the world, intelligence agency in the world. So when you look at it from that perspective, it's clear what Mr. Erdogan is doing. So those who want to believe that, no, he's sincere in his support for the Palestinian people, they're deceiving themselves. They're closing their eyes to reality. They can keep doing that, but it's not going to change anything. They can accuse Iran or Hezbollah or Ansarullah or whoever they want. But what he does is that he gives scholarships to Palestinians. He, with, of course, Western permission, he gives offices to political activists and Hamas and others. Why? Because the United States doesn't want, just like in Qatar. Why is Qatar allowed to have Al Jazeera, which supports the Palestinians but doesn't support the resistance? Al Jazeera doesn't support the axis of resistance. It tries to undermine it, and so does Qatar. But it supports the Palestinian people. Why? Because if the United States and the West were to shut down the cooperation between Qatar, Turkey, and Hamas, for example, then Hamas would no longer have any influence. They would no longer have any contacts. So they need some middlemen, some people to sort of stand in the middle to do their bidding. If there's no Al Jazeera, then people will turn to other media outlets. And those media outlets are media outlets that have that the West has no control over. If Hamas, remember the political wing of Hamas, if they're not able to stay in Qatar and Turkey, then they will have to stay in Iran. And that's not something that the Americans would like. So it is very complicated. But at the end of the day, there's no doubt that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are in the American camp. And whoever is working with them is working in coordination with Americans. So now look at Lebanon. They're trying to undermine the resistance, the Northern Front. If that happens, that's great news for Israel. Who's doing it? It's Jolani. It is the U.S.-installed government in Lebanon. It is Saudi Arabia. And it is Israel. All of them suddenly find an enemy that they all want to cooperate with one another to undermine. Their interests are the same. So Jolani is a part of the same broader Western project, whether it's Jolani or whether it's Samir Jaja, the fascist head of the Lebanese forces, who was involved in the slaughter, the massacre in Sabra and Shatila in 1982, where thousands of Palestinians and Lebanese were slaughtered in Beirut, in southern Beirut, at that time under Israeli supervision because Israelis had occupied. All these forces are working together to undermine the resistance. So, no one should be naive. Erdogan is pursuing his own interests, and that is to create a sort of mini Ottoman Empire in northern Syria, northern Lebanon, northern Iraq, and the Caucasus. And that empire runs in parallel with Greater Israel. There are points of contention. There are points of rivalry. But in general, all that Erdogan has done over the last few years is undermine the resistance, which has worked to the benefit. And so has Saudi Arabia. And so has Qatar, which have all worked to the benefit of the Israeli regime. There's zero doubt about that. If Turkey cut off ties with the Israeli regime, cooperated with the axis of resistance, the situation today would be very different from what it is now.
You mentioned the situation in Lebanon, Professor Mirandi. Do you feel that we know that there is a lot of pressure on Hezbollah and on the part of the government, the pressure coming from the United States, from the region, from Arab states, they all put in, they're doing everything to somehow disarm what they want to disarm Hezbollah. What does that mean for Lebanon? Because after all, we're talking about the security of Lebanon, the future of Lebanon. What do they want in your opinion? I'm talking about the Lebanese government right now. I'm talking about Hezbollah, the society in Lebanon. What would be beneficial for Lebanon in your opinion?
Well, the Lebanese government that's been installed by the United States, Saudi Arabia, they do what they're told. And of course, they have to deal with the reality on the ground too. But if they have to leave Lebanon one day and Lebanon is torn apart, they'll move with their families to the United States. Just like they'll go wherever Zelensky goes. Maybe not in the, not their palaces may not be as, or mansions may not be as elaborate, but they'll go to the same sort of place, Southern California, West Southern Florida, wherever Zelensky goes, they'll end up close by. What the Israeli regime wants is a broken Lebanon, a fragmented Lebanon, and they want to take southern Lebanon. They have ambitions in Lebanon, they have ambitions in Syria, they have ambitions in Jordan, and they have ambitions in Saudi Arabia, and they have ambitions in Egypt to a lesser degree. But their ambitions are to have the region fragmented. And if there's civil war in Lebanon, that's ideal for the Israeli regime. So the Saudis, by pushing for the disarmament of Lebanon, are pushing to empower the Israeli regime, because the only thing that stops the Israeli regime is Hezbollah. The Lebanese armed forces does not have the ability to defend the country. The Americans won't even allow them to have air defenses. They won't allow them to have an air force. They have nothing. If the Israelis storm Beirut, just like they did in 1982, it'll be taken in days, just like it was taken very swiftly back then. The only thing that stops them is the resistance. It's clear as day. So the objective of the Israeli regime is clear. And it is quite odd that those who are against Hezbollah, we know who they are. A lot of them are people who've been brought up to have an irrational sectarian hatred in our region, trained through Wahhabi, Salafi ideologues funded by, in the past more by Saudis, nowadays more by Qatar. I mean, one thing that people don't know is that the most important mosque in Qatar is the Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab Mosque. It is, the ideology is takfiri. That is, I mean, they may have pretty buildings, and they may have, you know, women in makeup on the TV channels and models, speaking to, but that's their ideology. So, it's very intolerant. And so those who are bound, who are closing their eyes to reality because of this this sectarian or religious or racial hatred that's been created within them, are closing their eyes to the reality that the only people who've sacrificed, that the group that has sacrificed more than anyone else for the people of Gaza is Hezbollah, more than Yemen. Because Yemen is far away. The Israelis bombed, the American bombs, but the Israelis are next door. In this war, 5,000 members during the last 2 years, 5,000 members of Hezbollah were martyred, and a couple of thousand family members. That's huge. No one, this is a small country. The sacrifices that Hezbollah has made to draw forces away from Gaza, and the battles in southern Lebanon were much heavier than what we saw at any time in Gaza. The Israeli regime went all in southern Lebanon, and they couldn't take any territory. And this during that whole period, their forces were drawn away from Gaza. And even now they have large numbers of forces in the north because they're concerned. Hezbollah wants to keep it that way so that they cannot focus completely on the south. So those who are conspiring against Hezbollah in Lebanon, they are in bed with the Israeli regime. And that means Jolani is in bed with the Israeli regime. Remember, Jolani has said repeatedly to the Israelis and to others that we have the same enemies, Iran and Hezbollah. He said that to the Israelis on multiple occasions through his messengers. Iran and Hezbollah. So Jolani, Saudi Arabia. By extension, Jolani is Qatar. And Erdogan. I don't want to say Turkey. Erdogan. And of course, the Sami Jaja, the fascists in Lebanon and the likes and people like him. All of them are in the same camp. And so those who, until now, they blinded themselves through sectarian hatred or Western propaganda, they should begin to open their eyes and see the reality of who really supports the Palestinian people and who doesn't. Just like when they claim that, I mean, it's interesting. Some people say that Iran, these people were very sectarian. They say Iran has done nothing for the Palestinians. Iran has done nothing for the Palestinians. Why did the Israelis bomb Iran? Why did they try to overthrow Iran? If they were just standing back doing nothing, then what's the purpose of having a war with Iran and getting hammered by Iranian missiles as a result? It's because Iran is supporting the resistance in Gaza and elsewhere. It's because Iran is what is blocking the Israeli regime from overrunning these territories. So, this is the reality on the ground, and whether some people like to believe it or not, it just depends on how, whether they want to open their eyes or not.
We had Steve Witkoff talking with Iranian and Russians, and suddenly he left the scene, and we had two attacks on Russia and Iran, pretty similar attacks using drones and the way that they were doing. So Steve Witkoff is back, and he's talking with Vladimir Putin. He had a meeting with him, and it seems that on Friday, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin would meet in Alaska. So what does that mean, in your opinion? Is the United States getting somewhere with the case of Ukraine, or they're somehow making some sort of political moves toward Russia? Because we know that the situation, the reason that I'm bringing this up is the complexity of the region, what's going on, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Ukraine, Russia, Iran, and it's all related to each other. Well, your take on what would happen in Friday or any sort of outcome?
Well, my understanding of Trump is that he's weak. He has a very weak personality. And one example of that is Witkoff himself. Witkoff, when he began to negotiate with Iran, he said one thing. Then after his interview on Fox News, he suddenly shifted, moved the goalposts. It was clear that Trump and Witkoff were under pressure. Of course, Witkoff is a Zionist. And so his interests lie with with Netanyahu and the directly, and with the Zionist lobby. But still, Witkoff works for Trump. So his shift in position, his total shift in position, was clear it showed clearly that Trump was weak, and under a little bit of pressure from the Zionist lobby, he would change his position. And then, of course, as the negotiations progress, and we saw that the United States was secretly plotting against Iran and using negotiations as deception. It wasn't as if the Iranians didn't know there was going to be an attack. I think I've said this before. The Iranians knew that the Israeli regime would launch war. I think the Iranians didn't believe that the Israelis would attack the highest officials of the land and military and civilian officials. That was a miscalculation, but the Iranians knew that they were going to attack. But I think that shows Trump's weakness and how easily he is manipulated. So when it comes to Russia, I think you have to keep that in mind, that Trump, without a doubt, recognizes that Ukraine is losing the war and the defense lines are falling apart. And we've been saying this for 3.5 years, that, you know, in Iran, a lot of people were skeptical, but it was clear from day one that Russia would win. I mean, there were ups and downs, but it was clear that Russia had the upper hand for 1,001 reasons that we don't need to get into. But now it's becoming clear that things are finally falling apart for Ukraine. And I think Trump wants to end the war. But the problem is that Trump no longer has the momentum that he had on day one when he came to power. If he had ended the war back then, he would have been able to do it from a much stronger position, and he had public support. But now, after Epstein, and Trump has lost credibility at home, the Epstein issue is very big in the United States, and it's not going to go away. And then after the situation in Ukraine has gotten worse, and after Trump has lost his momentum and his popular support, now if he concedes and to Russia, it'll be seen as capitulation and defeat. Because back then he could have said this is Biden's war. Now he can't say it's Biden's war. It's his war. In fact, it never was Biden's war. It was his war too, because the weapons that he gave to Ukraine, he always boasts about what he gave to Ukraine, the javelins and so on. So it was his war too. But let's say he would still say it's Biden war, and people, his supporters, would have believed him. So he could have ended it back then but he was a weak person. And he's a weak person, as we've seen with our negotiations, as we've seen when he failed to follow through on his promises about Ukraine, and even the trade wars. We saw how he took these bold and stupid positions against China, where he had to back down when the bond market began to become dangerous. It became dangerous for the U.S. economy. So he's a weak person. I think that he is raising expectations. So something has to happen in Alaska, because it would be very bad if the two presidents meet and nothing positive comes out of this. Because usually when two presidents meet, the agreements have already been made. There may be some, you know, small issues that are stuck, and then the two presidents solve it before they meet or during their meetings. But they don't just go in and talk and then walk away with failure, because that looks very bad. So they need some sort of agreement, especially Trump. President Putin, probably less so, but still, there are expectations have been raised. But what can Trump give? If he concedes significant amounts of territory, then he will be depicted as a defeated president, someone who's probably involved, deeply involved with Epstein, and, you know, all these will start coming with it. All of everything, you know, there will be a pile on Epstein, the economy, corruption, you know, the genocide in Gaza. People across the United States and Europe are turning against the Israeli regime. All these will be used simultaneously to bring him down, to weaken him. So if he concedes a lot, then he will be seen as defeated. If President Putin concedes after all these Russians who've been killed, and after they changed the constitution and added these territories to Russia, then he will be in a very difficult position. I don't know if it would be sustainable. So how do the two sides bridge this huge gap? I don't know. I think the smartest thing to do, if you know, would be to have some sort of minor agreements. However, I don't know, a sort of ceasefire, limited ceasefire where, I don't know, for a number of days, less drones are fired, or certain targets are not visited, or, you know, fewer missiles are used, or certain areas where that are not attacked, or something like that, for 30 days or 15 days. But I don't think there's a chance for a ceasefire, because that would be very bad for Russia. It would halt their momentum. I don't think that Trump can concede all that territory, because it would be very bad for him. Again, as I said, 6 months ago, it would have been fine. The neocons would have lashed out at him, but he would have been able to do it. But now, I don't think so. And as I said, since he's a weak person, I find it very difficult to imagine him doing what needs to be done to end the war.
I think when we look at the way that the United States is trying to negotiate with both Iran and Russia, it's pretty the same. Sending Steve Witkoff, sending a message, or maybe in some sort of 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hours of talk. But you look at Iranian team going to Russia, and you have people there taking notes and getting what is the main point of the negotiation talks that are happening. Every time we see Russians or Iranians, Chinese, you see these people are, you see team coming up and making the deal and talking, negotiating, and they have speaker and the other people are around and taking notes. But you don't see that happening with the United States. I don't know, how can you imagine that they're serious in the sort of negotiations that they're trying to implement, to trying to do with Iran? How does it feel when it comes to Iran? Because Iran was negotiating, as you mentioned, with the United States, and I see the same way they're doing with Russia. How does it feel to talk this way to the government of the United States?
I think doing a deal with the United States is almost impossible. I would say impossible, but I don't think we should, speak in absolute terms. It's almost impossible, because we've already seen how, as I said earlier, how Witkoff moved the goalposts. The goalposts were in a place initially where we could have had a deal. The Iranians were willing to compromise over the nuclear program for a period of time. A better deal than the JCPOA was something, the Iranian wouldn't have accepted another JCPOA, but a reasonable deal where both sides could have been satisfied. It was doable. But Trump couldn't do it, because he's weak, because the Zionist lobby influences him. And the same is true with regards to Russia and the neocons. And there's a lot of overlap between the Zionist lobby and the neocons. They're almost the same, really. They are the same sort. So as long as you have the neocons with this influence, then whatever Trump says doesn't really, isn't a yes is not a yes. A no is not a no. You don't know what Trump will do the following day. If anyone just analyzes his social media posts and his statements, they'll see that he's all over the place. And he's, you know, insulting one world leader after another, one American after another, his own allies. He calls his own MAGA supporters. He insults them and he belittles them. He uses bad language when he speaks about them, insulting and humiliating language. It's almost impossible to define his behavior. You cannot predict his future behavior and language. He doesn't seem to have any strategy whatsoever. The people around him are not very sophisticated. They're not very bright. They're not very smart. And they're a bunch of yes men. Obviously, no one is telling him to, you know, stop posting stupid, you know, things online. No one will tell him that. And then you see the White House, you know, posting him as Superman and very unbelievably childish thing. This is the White House. It's like in Iran, the leader's office, the president's office doing something. And if the president or the leader's office did something like that, the whole country would be embarrassed. I don't think we can have any expectations from the United States. We cannot trust anyone in the United States, and therefore, I don't think an agreement is really possible. I'm not saying it's impossible. I think one reason why the Iranians continue to negotiate is that they want the world to see that they are not the problem. It's very important for the Russians and the Iranians and the Chinese and others to be seen as reasonable. Because it's very easy to show how unreasonable the Americans are if you're just a bit careful. So sometimes some people get very angry by certain statements made by certain Iranian officials. I'm not saying that all the statements made by some, like the president or senior officials in the foreign ministry are always right or good. No, some of the statements made by the president, I think, were not good. Some of them were taken out of context, as in a couple of days ago, where there was a lot of anger. But it turned out that he was responding to a question, but it was taken out of context. But the point is that a lot of this diplomatic language is used and deployed so that the world will see that Iran is reasonable. Because remember, for decades, through Western propaganda, through Saudi propaganda, through Qatari propaganda, through oil and gas funded propaganda, the Iranians were always demonized. The Iranians were always depicted as irrational and dangerous and so on. And Iranians, you know, it completely negative. That has changed completely because the world now sees that it is Iran that's opposing this Holocaust. It is Iran's allies that are the ones who are opposing the Holocaust. They're the ones who are paying the price. So now that Iran has such a support, such significant support across the board, they want to strengthen it and preserve it. So they have to be seen as being willing to engage and to be reasonably flexible. But that doesn't mean that Iran is going to capitulate. I think those who read this sort of thing into Iranian statements made by Iranian officials are reading too much, far too much into these statements.
How do you feel about Israel and the way that it seems that many people are talking about that Israel would attack Iran? And I literally talk with everybody that I talk with. They believe that Israel wants to attack Iran. How prepared is Iran if Israel decides to go in that direction?
The Iranians today are much more prepared than they were when the Israeli regime attacked the first time. And the Israeli regime tried to overthrow Iran. They gave it their best. They used their best technology. As I said before on your show, what the Israeli regime has, Zelensky can only dream of. And they used everything they had. And they failed. The Iranians, they have been studying what happened during those 12 days. And they've been preparing themselves for another war. We don't know if the regime will attack, but I think that if it does, it'll be much worse for the regime this time around. Iran is it is significantly more prepared than it was back then. And Iran now knows the Israeli regime's strengths, and it better understands its weaknesses, its vulnerabilities, and is dealing with them. So I don't think things are going to end well for the regime in case of a new war. Especially because it's so deeply despised. Every day that goes by, the world hates the Israeli regime more than before, especially since the images of starving people have begun to come out of Gaza. And this is something that your viewers have to all be active on. They have to increase awareness about the Holocaust in Gaza, because the Western media is trying to hide it as much as possible. But in any case, the regime, as time goes on, the regime is becoming increasingly despised. Now, some people will say, who cares? They'll kill, and then 5 years later, people will forget. I don't believe that. Every day that goes by, the animosity for the regime is becoming stronger and deeper, and it's going to expand further. And this will have huge consequences. So I think the weeks ahead for the Israeli regime are also going to be very tough because of what Netanyahu said about Gaza. And it will be difficult for him to engage or have a war with Iran or attack Lebanon right now because he's focusing on Gaza. Of course, there could be deception and he may actually try to move towards Lebanon. But, you know, I would assume that right now his focus is on Gaza. So I think engaging in a war with Iran right now would be very difficult for him. And engaging a war in Lebanon would be difficult for him too. But anything can happen. And also, I would not rule out an Iranian strike on the Israeli regime, depending on what happens in Gaza or Lebanon. Because remember, we don't have a ceasefire. Iran did not accept a ceasefire. On the day when the fighting stopped, many people said, why did you say that there was no ceasefire? There is no ceasefire. There's a halt in hostility. There's a cessation of hostilities. The Iranians said, if they stop, we'll stop. During the last 2-3 hours, the Iranians hammered the regime. The last strikes were Iranian strikes, which were very significant and very painful for the regime. But there's no ceasefire. And so the Israeli regime should be looking to the sky at all times. But Iran is preparing itself. But what is most important now is public pressure. I think people should recognize those who've closed their eyes till now through blind sectarianism and hatred. They should look carefully at what's happening in Lebanon and see really who stands where. Who is on the right side of history? Is it really ISIS and Al-Qaeda and those forces in Lebanon that are affiliated to the West? Do you really want to stand with these people against the resistance which gave so many lives to help the people of Gaza? Do you want to stand with the Americans against Iran? Do you want to stand with the Israelis against, or the Saudis against Yemen, or Erdogan against the resistance? If that's where, you know, if someone takes this stance, you know, they are on the wrong side of history. They can pretend that they are not on the wrong side of history, but that's exactly what the Zionists do and their supporters do. They will be no different from the Zionists. They'll be the same thing, but they'll be doing the same thing in a different framework. They'll be taking the same sort of position, but within a different context.
We know that Israel is talking about capturing all of Gaza and controlling Gaza. And the reaction coming from Europeans, from mostly most of the governments in the Western, in Europe, they believe that is not the case. They're not agreeing on what Netanyahu is talking about. But after all, do you see Netanyahu capable of doing it? Because they've been fighting Hamas and they couldn't achieve it. They couldn't defeat Hamas. And they're talking about capturing all of Gaza. And how do you see the situation in Gaza? We know that starvation is going on, but do you feel that Europeans finally would support? They're against the policy that Netanyahu is somehow trying to spread, trying to talk about. How do you find it there?
No, the Europeans don't care about the Palestinian people. European elites, North American elites, Australian, New Zealand, they don't care about the Palestinian people. Just like the elites in our part of the world in the Persian Gulf region, and that's why they don't care about the Palestinian people. Why? Look at the West Bank. In the West Bank, they don't have to take a stance. But what's happening today in the West Bank is horrific. Killings, the destruction of neighborhoods, the theft of water. That's the next Holocaust. The next Holocaust will be in the West Bank. And it's already beginning. The ethnic cleansing in the West Bank is horrific. But do you see anything about it in the Western media? Do you see Western embassies in occupied Palestine making any statements? No, because if they don't have to, they won't. The New York Times, the Washington Post, Reuters, Associated Press, CNN, Fox News, Breitbart, The Guardian, The Independent, France 24, The Times, BBC, Sky, none of them are going to say anything about the West Bank as far as possible. They don't care. They're fine with the Israelis doing what they need to do. The reason why now they're being forced to take this stance in Gaza is because everyone has woken up to the reality and they are being discredited. Western media is discredited. Western journalists are seen as complicit in a Holocaust. Western leaders are seen as complicit. So they have to take the smallest steps that they have to in order to remain relevant, in order to prevent their societies from becoming more outraged. They're afraid of losing control. So they have to take these tiny steps, like, you know, saying that we may recognize a Palestinian state, recognizing a Palestinian state on a piece of paper as the Palestinians are being slaughtered and ethnically cleansed doesn't mean anything. So these minimum steps that are being taken, whether in the media or in politics, and right now the West is continuing to increase sanctions on Iran, but there are no sanctions on Israel. I mean, maybe a couple of people are sanctioned from traveling to Europe. Who cares? It has zero impact. And that is the objective, not to have any real impact on what the Israeli regime is doing. So the West is with the political establishment in the West is with the Israeli regime. And even in the region, as we see people starving, we don't see any, you know, Turkey and Erdogan and Aliyev cutting off the oil trade. Some people say Aliyev, Erdogan is not responsible. Aliyev, if Erdogan wants Aliyev to stop, he will stop. He will stop that day. And it's not just oil from Aliyev. It's also Kurdish oil. I mean, well, Syrian oil controlled by U.S. proxies in Syria that are being sent to Turkey and exported to Israel. And the same thing was happening in northern Iraq. So, and then you see the Emirates and you see Mohammed bin Salman conspiring in Lebanon. So as the starvation continues, the elites in the West and their, you know, along with their regional allies and proxies, they are pursuing the same policy. However, the world is changing very fast and the Israelis have failed on all fronts. I do not believe that the Israelis have succeeded in Lebanon or Yemen or Gaza or against Iran. They failed on all these fronts. In Syria, you know, it's a more complicated situation. I don't think that Netanyahu can take Gaza. And I think time, you know, what he's doing is he's destroying the Israeli regime, because he's working for his own interests and the interests of his fanatical allies more than anything else. He wants to stay out of jail. And this is not in the interest of the regime. So I think that the more genocide we have, the more slaughter we have, the more costly it will be for the regime, of course, militarily and financially. But most importantly, the hatred for the regime that we're seeing grow across the world will continue. And I don't think that is something that can be ignored. It is reaching a point where it can no longer be ignored.
Thank you so much, Professor Marandi, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nima. Great speaking with you and being able to speak with your audience.
Thank you.